Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. This is a once-in-a-lifetime takeaway. I mean, you've got the chance this hour to sing a duet with Katie Lang. Right? Or sing a duet with Placido Domingo. There's a challenge. That's a dream. That's a dream. You can co-host with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. Start up a business with Warren Buffett. Design a building with Frank Gehry. Make a movie with Steven Spielberg. Dream on later this hour. The magic of pairs and the genius of collaboration. Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, John Coltrane, Miles Davis. This hour, the partner who completes you. Genius often comes in pairs. Who's the Rogers to your Hammerstein?
This is Jessica calling from Austin, Texas. And if I were to be able to collaborate with anyone living or dead on a creative project, I would choose to collaborate with my sister. She lives in Cape Town, South Africa, and is a filmmaker. I'm a musician and performer, and I have a plethora of interesting and creative projects to work on with her.
Get started. Sounds like a sister act. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to tell us your dream better half. But first, we go to Afghanistan. A major general has died, the highest-ranking member of the U.S. military to be killed in action in Afghanistan. It happened at a military training facility on the outskirts of Kabul, reportedly shot dead by an Afghan soldier at that training base, a possible insider attack, an Afghan soldier opening fire on coalition forces. Joining us is foreign correspondent Matthew Rosenberg in Kabul for our partner, The New York Times. Matthew, does this look like one of the so-called insider attacks at this point?
It does. And then the question always is, well, was this guy working for the Taliban or was he not? It's always incredibly difficult to say. The Taliban is not taking credit, which is unusual. They usually do pretty quickly. Their spokesman told us they were still trying to figure out what had happened. And, you know, a lot of these insider attacks have, over the years, Afghan and American officials have concluded that it's Afghans who have grown very alienated and very angry about the foreign presence here, and in some ways internalized the Taliban narrative without actually joining the Taliban.
Speaking with Matthew Rosenberg via Skype from Kabul, a major general is killed in this incident. Is there any indication that the rank was the nature of the attack here on some level?
We just don't know. I mean, presumably the Afghan soldier would have known that the man with stars on his shoulders was important. And he was said to have been shot at close range, which makes it sound like he was aiming at this major general. But we just don't know details yet. The camp where it happened is locked down tight. The coalition here is locked down tight. Even at the Pentagon, they're not saying much.
Matthew Rosenberg, I'm looking at some of the reports from various media in Kabul. And it's curious to me, even the Taliban spokesman that you mentioned, there is an assumption that there are plants and that there are agents inside these training facilities. The Taliban is said to have regularly their people working at these training facilities. This isn't necessarily just some rogue individual who turns a gun out of frustration.
It's not. And I think there's an assumption that the Taliban has sympathizers in a lot of places. But, you know, there's not a whole lot of evidence that most of these attacks are pre-planned by the Taliban or a Taliban sleeper or something of that nature. In the preponderance of insider attacks, it is, by most accounts, appear to be Afghans who simply don't want to see foreign affair anymore. Quite a frightening prospect. You know, it's one thing if it's a Taliban sleeper agent, something, but if it's just a random person who decides, you know what, I'm tired of these foreigners, they've killed too many Afghans, I'm going to shoot one, how do you guard against that? You know, it's a much more difficult proposition.
What does this do for the mission? I mean, there's all kinds of, pride associated with trying to train this Afghan force. And even this training facility has, you know, pretenses of the military academies.
You know, it's another blow to it. How big an effect it has, an immediate effect, it's hard to say. You know, the obvious immediate effect is they tighten security again. When insider attacks became a real problem in 2012, you started having American trainers training people in their body armor. You know, you put up walls between you and the people you're training to protect yourself, but that also alienates them and further makes it more difficult to get the training done and to have any real meaningful presence here, and makes it more dangerous in some ways because people who are alienated and feel distant from you are much more likely to attack you. It's hard to say what the political fallout will be back in the U.S. And a big selling point for the continued presence of Americans here through 2016 was that they wouldn't be in frontline roles and they would be away from danger. And that is true. They're not in frontline roles, but they're not away from danger.
It's got to be demoralizing to conduct training in your own personal green zone.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think, you know, today at the headquarters of the coalition, we're told that the commanding general, General Dunford, U.S. Marine, held a series of closed-door meetings, first with his very senior officers, then slightly less senior officers, try and take everybody's temperature, reassure people, and keep things on track. But they also called all their advisors back and really climbed down on security just to make sure everybody was accounted for and then decide how to move forward. This does make things harder and more complicated.
It's untenable, I gather, to run a training facility and not giving the Afghans actual weapons, right?
It's totally untenable. And, you know, the Afghan military faces real threats. They need guards. They have to guard their own facilities. There's nobody else to do it for them. And those guards need to have weapons. It's just impossible. You're fighting a war that is now fought largely by Afghan forces. They're going to be very armed. They're going to be all around you. And even on the street where we live, every day I walk past Afghan policemen and others. I try and smile and be nice. But, you know, there's no way to avoid heavily armed Afghans in Afghanistan. It is what it is.
Any sense of the fallout here in the early going, demoralization on the part of U.S. soldiers, a sense of frustration on the part of Afghans at this point?
You know, it's hard to say. People are really clammed up. I think there certainly is a degree of shock, and that will be followed by some demoralization. It is just one man in a war where a lot of other people have died, but it's a major general, and it's the highest ranking officer who have died in this war. We're checking right now, but we believe it may well be the highest, the first general killed since Vietnam. That's a significant symbolic death that is not going to help keep morale high and keep people pressing forward on the mission.
Foreign correspondent Matthew Rosenberg is in Kabul for our partner, The New York Times. Matthew, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's the second day of the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in Washington, D.C., a summit supposed to be all about finding economic opportunities in countries with high growth potential in Africa, along with serious social and political challenges. Yesterday, we spoke with an author from Zimbabwe who experienced the human rights record and criticism of Zimbabwe's government as a real wall of tension between the U.S. and the government of Robert Mugabe and her own family back in Zimbabwe. There is no such problem with Nigeria, though. Oil rich, with a legendary reputation for corruption and a questionable human rights record to match, Nigeria and the U.S. are close partners right now, most recently cooperating on the Boko Haram terrorist attacks and the latest Ebola outbreak. Chigozie Obioma is a Nigerian writer and author of the forthcoming novel, The Fisherman. He left Nigeria in 2007 in order to find a way to write about his home. Chigozie, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, John.
How much does principle get in the way of you thinking about your home and the place where you grew up?
Well, Nigeria, as you said, has been known, has had some kind of interesting status or stigma, let me say, to be direct, in, you know, the views of many people outside of the continent of Africa. And so I use the people of Nigeria as the laboratory specimen to try to understand humanity, the complexities of humanity. And I try to write about a people who, despite the challenges that they face, try to live like every other person lives in this world.
Would you say the oil boom has helped the people of Nigeria or has hurt?
Well, the oil boom is definitely seen by many as a cause in Nigeria, especially. And prior to the 1954 discovery of oil in the west of, in the Niger Delta of Nigeria, Nigeria had a thriving agricultural sector. But once the oil boom came, everything went down, and there was this mad rush for gold, let me say. And The oil has brought a lot of corruption into the country. There is a lot of dependency almost on the gains of oil, that there is this kind of complacency, this laziness to invent anything, to think about anything. Everyone wants to dip their hands into the spoils of oil. And this is one of the major reasons why Nigeria has been backward. It was the reason for the civil war, one of the most internecine wars in human history, and has been the bane, so to say, of Nigeria's nationhood.
Would you say that the profile of the Boko Haram attacks, even the concern about the Ebola virus and other issues, and particularly the profile of so many great Nigerian writers right now writing in English, has made Nigeria closer to the United States? The people of the United States have more of a sense of the people of Nigeria?
I think so. The U.S.-Nigerian relationship, the ideological root of it, has actually started from like the 18th century when W.E.B. Du Bois started looking for how to connect back with the people in Africa. But through the writings of Achebe, to be specific, many Americans have been able to come to understand, even if it's on the surface, about what Nigeria is all about. But the recent rise in the Nigerian terrorist situation right now has also brought Nigeria to the news. But there's a lot of skepticism about U.S. intervention or relationship with Nigeria, especially in trying to contain the excesses of this terrorist group, Boko Haram. You know, we've always seen the U.S. as being interested in Nigeria's oil, and our relationship has actually grown together in correlation with the oil boom in Nigeria. But in recent time, the oil import has from Nigeria to the U.S. has decreased, and people are hoping that the U.S. relationship with Nigeria would not decrease now that, you know, they no longer look to Nigeria for this. And I hope that the U.S. would also do more in trying to denounce and hold the whip, actually, against the Nigerian government to stamp out corruption and be able to establish a sustainable, viable system of accountability, which is definitely needed. As John Campbell, a former ambassador of the U.S. to Nigeria, once said, that the Nigerians are reluctant to ask U.S. for help, as you saw in the Boko Haram situation of the girls who were captured, because help from the U.S. usually come with degrees of accountability where the Nigerians don't like.
Before we go, I can't resist asking you the question, what is it that you most often tell Americans in Ann Arbor or wherever you are about your country, to correct them, to make them know something really positive about Nigeria?
You know, I always say that the first thing that a writer or anybody who tends to be an artist has, you know, what he owes humanity, and which is truth. So I try to say what I think or what I feel as a truth. And so if they ask me, how is your country, and should I visit, I always say, well, you can visit, but there are better places in Africa to actually visit. If you must visit Nigeria, visit with someone you know, because the corruption in Nigeria is truly skin deep, and it's a serious problem. You don't know what will happen to you when you visit there. And I also tell people that the people still have this humanity in them, you know, but the polity itself is not sustainable. So Nigeria definitely needs to do more so that when we talk about, we who are in diaspora talk about the country, we can talk about it with pride, and our truth will be the actual truth and reality.
Chigozie Obioma, Nigerian writer and author of the forthcoming novel, The Fisherman. He spoke to us from Ann Arbor. Chigozie, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, John.
Healthy, fast food. It's a quest of consumers to find it, and it's a quest of junk-branded drive-thrus to get beyond the trans-fat crowd, right? Does it take more than a salad and a gluten-free bagel to achieve this? Some Subway veggies? It's not the first time fast food has tried to get healthy, But can we take it seriously this time around? Dan Pashman is the host of WNYC's Sporkful Food podcast and author of the forthcoming book, Eat More Better. Fast food and sustainability, fast food and health, fast food and locavore missions. What are we talking about here? All of the above?
To a point, yes. I mean, the whole fast food genre that has been dubbed fast casual is a major growth area in this industry. Basically, you're talking about a higher quality of food. You're talking about quote-unquote fast food restaurants that have grass-fed beef, that use local and sometimes organic produce, that have menus that change with the seasons, as does the availability of different ingredients. And so really the kinds of things that you would see at a higher end restaurant, in theory, you're now going to see at a place like Tender Greens, for instance, which their food doesn't have basil, John. It has Thai basil.
And how is this marketed? Does the happy meal become the happy cow, the happy beef?
Yeah, I mean, look, a lot of this has to do with the success of Chipotle, which has made major gains in the chain restaurant world. A big part of Chipotle's pitch is our meat comes from animals that are treated better. We put thought and care into where our ingredients come from. And, you know, it seems obvious that that has struck a chord. Chipotle has managed to bring in a lot of the people who have stopped eating at McDonald's and Burger King will still go eat at Chipotle.
So the model is not to change pre-existing sort of Big Mac brands, but to create a brand, the umbrella of which is sustainable everything on the menu. Chipotle did it. What are some other options?
Well, I mean, there's a place called Tender Greens. There's one called Life Kitchen. There's one called Sweet Green. There's a vegan vegetarian one called Native Foods. And if you look at the menu of these places, you'll see things like grilled Thai octopus salad. Not exactly a top seller at McDonald's, I'm sure. But I mean, I do have to say, look, I think it's great that these restaurants are flourishing. I certainly like the idea of having more healthy, local, sustainable meals prepared with some level of awareness about the environment. All that stuff is great. That being said, I'm a little bit skeptical about just how new this really is. I think that there are restaurants and chains out there that have been doing things along these lines. And the other thing I'm skeptical about is scale. A lot of these places have 5, 10, 20 restaurants right now, and they're doing really well in those 10 or 20 restaurants. But I don't know how many of the people who are regularly still going to McDonald's and Burger King are going to pay $11.50 for a steak sandwich for lunch or $11.50 for a tuna niçoise salad. So I think that the idea of these guys ever really competing with the big boys is something that I'm still skeptical of.
All right. So Dan Pashman doesn't think McDonald's has much to worry about here. But from the consumer perspective, are we buying a kind of gourmet smugness on the fast food scale, or are we really buying health?
I think you're buying smug health. I mean, I think there's no question that these restaurants are using a higher quality of ingredients, prepared more thoughtfully, and it is healthier. But I had to get a kick out of looking at some of these menus. It made me think of a recent episode of The Sporkful, where I interviewed a guy named Doug Sohn. He runs a famous hot dog and sausage joint in Chicago called Hot Doug's. And he said, when I talked to him, he said, the best thing I learned in culinary school, side of peas, $1. Petit pois à la française, $3.75. So it's some from column A, some from column B.
Free range seltzer water.
Yeah.
Something like that. Dan Pashman, the host of WNYC's Sporkful Food podcast and author of the forthcoming book, Eat More Better. Keep eating more better.
I will. Thanks, John.
Is there a right to farm? This curious question is on the ballot in Missouri today as a coalition of state farming groups and large agricultural corporations are pushing an amendment to guarantee that citizens be allowed to engage in farming and ranching practices. Is this a back to the land movement in Missouri or a vaguely worded ploy to get around some government regulations at the expense of vulnerable consumers? Joe Mannies is a political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. What's going on here, Joe?
Well, a lot of this is, in effect, payback for what happened in 2010 when the Humane Society and a number of animal rights groups got on the ballot a proposition to change state law to impose more restrictions on dog breeding in the state. That narrowly passed, in part because of an urban-suburban versus rural split. Most of the rural voters voted against it. Most of the urban and suburban voters voted for it, so it narrowly passed. So after that, because it was a proposition and not a change in the Constitution, the next year the General Assembly, which is largely dominated by rural interests, blocked many of those restrictions from going into effect. And then they wanted to do something to make sure that this didn't happen again. Many of them felt that there was an attempt to unfairly restrict farming practices, and many of them consider dog breeding to be among the farming practices used in the state because many of the dog breeders in the state are actually farmers. So there was a proposal then to put a constitutional amendment in the ballot. The aim was to restrict additional government regulations on farming at all levels. And some of the corporate interests also got involved because we do have several major large hog farms that are corporate owned. And some of them have been in war with some of the local jurisdictions nearby over air, water pollution, perceived smelling, that sort of thing. So you came up with this proposed constitutional amendment, got on the ballot. Initially, it was believed to be an easy win. But since then, and the last couple weeks, some animal rights groups and others have put together some money to put some opposition ads on the air. So you have them versus many of the agriculture interests in the state, like the Soybean Association, the Missouri Pork Association. Many of those are putting money in support of the Right to Farm Amendment. So it's coming down to the wire, and the general perception is that today's vote is going to be close.
How would it work in actual practice, this constitutional amendment? Would it mean that if some regulation had the effect of shutting down a hog farm, it would be null and void, something like that?
Well, there is thought that that would be true, or that it would at least could elicit some legal fights over it. Now, I want to emphasize that many of the supporters of this amendment have not been stealth about it, and a number of the Republican officials, including our state auditor, our current lieutenant governor, they've all been very upfront about the aim is to curb and prevent a redo of what happened in 2010 with the restrictions on dog breeding. There's been some back and forth about how much corporate farms would really be affected by this. Some of the supporters say that the concerns aired by the opponents is overblown. And the opponents also have put up an ad contending that passage of this law could make it easier for the Chinese to own land in Missouri. And actually, that's one of the ads that's been most effective. Whether or not it's true or not, this is one of the types of messages that has been pretty heavy on television the last few days.
Is there any clarity as far as consumers are concerned about whether to vote one way or the other?
No. Now, one of the things that's been interesting is that most of the newspapers in the state, and this includes in rural Missouri, have come out against it, which I think surprised some of the supporters. So many people are going to be watching the demographics of today's vote, as well as just the sheer, does it win or does it not win?
Agribusiness in Missouri and animal rights groups fighting over a constitutional amendment that would guarantee a right to engage in farming and ranching practices. Joe Manny's political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for asking me.
Upon your knee.
I like that.
Just tea for two and two for tea.
Uh-huh.
Just Sammy Davis and Carmen McRae. What are some other twosomes? There's Steve Jobs and Wozniak. There's Abbott and Costello. There's Woodward and Bernstein. Who would you make creative tea with?
This is Allison Katsoufrakis calling from Portland, Oregon. I think the person I would choose was Evelyn Glennie.
Evelyn Glennie, the drummer who can't hear and instead feels her rhythms.
As a fellow percussionist, specifically a female, and also someone who is along the spectrum of hard of hearing, she's really inspired me to not just feel limited by your disabilities, but to learn how those disabilities can help strengthen other ways to experience music and to experience creativity just through your whole body rather than one particular medium.
That's a good one. Twosomes that made history, like the Wright brothers. One of you in Alpharetta, Georgia, wonders what it would have been like to have had poet Pablo Neruda as a collaborative partner for poetry and plays. Oh, I get by. We asked you at thetakeaway.org and at 877-8-MY-TAKE who you would choose to partner up with if you could pick anyone. And we heard from a would-be John Lennon in San Antonio, Texas. Paul McCartney, because my voice fits within John Lennon's range, and I would like to rekindle some of that Lennon-McCartney magic. Well, the Lennon-McCartney magic and the importance of other historic collaborations is the subject of a new book, Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs by Joshua Wolf Schenck. Genius, he says, loves company.
What I found when I started to look into this phenomenon we call chemistry or synergy between people, and started with Lennon, McCartney, and so on, that this quality is not just incidental, but really the story of creativity. We don't hear about it a lot of time because the stories of these partners are hidden for a variety of reasons. There's so many manifestations of these relationships, brothers and married couples and, you know, friends from Liverpool and fellow scientists who find each other in the lab, and Larry Page and Sergey Brin met on a tour of Stanford. There are lots of ways that the relationships initiate, and there are lots of forms that they take. It's also true that you don't need to be in a room with someone to be creating with them. A lot of the real energy happens when someone gets up in your head, and that can happen at a great distance. In fact, you know, even intensely collaborative creative work still depends on solitude a lot of the time. And so one of the things that pairs need to do is negotiate how much distance they have from each other geographically, psychologically, and in terms of time.
I'm struck by how diverse these collaborations are. Is it a myth to think of these as roles like good cop, bad cop, or nerd versus poet like Wozniak and Steve Jobs?
I did find over and over again that there are archetypes for pairs and that they do tend to fall into these patterns over and over again. Very often, one member of a partnership is on stage in front of the adoring crowds and very well known, while the other is off stage in the wings. And many attributes tend to go along with these qualities. Very often, one is very ordered and structured, and the other is very disordered and pushing against convention and form. At the same time, though, the real energy is in the union and the way these things come together. And so you can begin by looking at two like electrical poles, you know, planted at opposite ends of a field. But as you get closer and closer, that metaphor needs to switch, and you need to look at two people like who are tumbling around each other like in a clothes dryer.
Give me an example of a pairing where one is very much out of sight and yet the relationship, the collaboration is absolutely essential. Both characters are absolutely essential to the creativity.
The story of Vincent van Gogh and his brother. Theo is well known to people who are very close students of van Gogh as a supporter of his brother. But in fact, they both thought that they were co-creating that work. Warren Buffett, who's known around the world as the Oracle of Omaha, has had a partner from the very beginning in Charlie Munger, who is extremely intimately involved in that whole process. And Buffett has even joked that Charlie does the talking, I just move my lips.
Does the collaboration remain a kind of two-person phenomenon if it's enlarged into more of a committee, even small groups that accomplish great things? Or is it a completely different dynamic when you get into threes and fours?
Well, what I found is that, larger groups are often relevant, and of course, there are ways of modeling them, but a sociologist named Michael Farrell looked at all sorts of circles. He looked at the suffragists, he looked at the impressionists, and he found that the groups are, they do matter. They create a culture, they create a sense of ethos, but that the really critical advances happen in a pair, because there's something very special when you're in a dyad. You can create a whole society that could be your whole world, because we are social creatures and we do require at least one other person to make our world, but it's still immensely fluid and flexible and can change very easily. The moment you add even a third person, it adds stability and structure. It's like the third leg of a table, and that often is very helpful, but it makes it less dynamic. There's a reason why, two legs are for running and three legs are for a table.
Scientifically speaking, what do you think is going on in the brain of Lennon when he's working with McCartney and McCartney when he's working with Lennon?
I don't know that neuroscience has a whole lot to show us yet about the particular mechanisms. You know, we do know enough to see that our brains are totally tied to our experience of other people. And John Lennon is a great example because we think of him as he was just so much himself. He was this swaggering guy, you know, constantly playing with language and pushing against form. We think that he, you know, he would just be that way in any context, but he only was able to be that way because he was in relationship to a guy like Paul and to some other people in his life at other times who gave him structure and form and allowed him to take a song like Strawberry Fields, which was very flat and really poetic.
That is, you can't, you know, tune in, but it's all right. That is, I think it's not too bad.
And it became this lush, orchestral, very full piece that McCartney was the arranger for.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever.
And McCartney, you know, someone who in another context might have been, and in his later work was, a little bit cliched and a little bit simplistic and a little bit too poppy. And he was just constantly deepened and challenged by his relationship to John, both by what John would directly say to him and by the implicit challenge of John writing a song like Strawberry Fields Forever and Paul thinking, I got to top this. I got to do just as good or better. I want to have the A side of the single, which is what those guys were constantly doing.
A life of looking for collaborators in some sense. Joshua Wolff-Shank, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Joshua Wolff-Shank is the author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. Who's your co-pilot? Give us your collaborative sort of wish list. If you want to catch up that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, you can check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening, or think of it as co-hosting. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.